All right, so if you want to pull out your handout, we'll just kind of walk through this today. Hopefully everyone knows that we are continuing a class that we began last week, a series that will be considering the text on the Incarnation by the Church Father Athanasius, and fairly brief texts, printed about 72 pages in this edition at least. And we'll just be working through it week by week as we go for the next, certainly through the season of Advent and Christmas, and maybe even for a few weeks into January as well. So just to review a little bit from last week, things that we discussed. So who is Athanasius, first of all? What do we talk about last week in terms of Athanasius and his context, his time in history? Yeah, how? Yep, good. Mm-hmm. Excellent. Right, and where is Alexandria? In Egypt. So, right, so Athanasius, that's a great summary. So Athanasius is first becomes a convert in, or he actually probably grows up in a Christian family in Alexandria, and he becomes a first assistant to the bishop, a deacon in the church in the early 4th century, and then around 330 or so, he becomes the bishop of Alexandria. And as Hal mentioned, at that time, we think maybe Alexandria, you know, is off the beaten path, you know, that kind of thing. But in the 4th century, this Alexandria was one of the centers of the Christian world. It was a place where the city was very, very much dominated by the Christian faith, and there are many scholars. Much education and learning was happening there. And so Athanasius was at the center of that. And we talked some about last week, too, about Athanasius' involvement in a controversy, right? What was that controversy that he was involved in for most of his life? Yeah, Carrie. Right, the Arius' heresy, right. So Athanasius was combating, during most of his life, Arius' false teaching, which was, how would we summarize that? Right. That's a really short kind of expression of what the crystallization of what Athanasius or Arius taught, that there was a time when the sun wasn't, so he must have been created, therefore. That's an interesting question. I mean, I think the baseline issue is that if we understand divinity, to be divine is to be pre-existent, to be eternally existent.
But I
think it's a question of the divinity of Christ, and if he is not really divine, then what does that mean in terms of us being united to him? You know, does that really give us entrance into the life of God? What does that mean in terms of him being able to serve as a substitutionary sacrifice on behalf of humanity? And so I think that's where things begin to unravel if we go down the road of the Son not being divine. And yeah, ultimately the problem is he's a man like us, essentially, at the end of the day. He's a created being. Maybe he's a more glorious created being, but at the end of the day, he is like us in a way that I think prevents him from carrying out salvation the way that we would understand it. And we talked last week, you know, there's some attraction to that because maybe that means he's more relatable, you know, that we can identify him if he's a created being like we are. And that's probably some of the attraction of Mormonism is that, you know, the idea that the Son of God was created but then becomes divine in a sense. And so we kind of follow in that train is you know the way that Mormon doctrine would teach, and so that's so that you know there's certainly some attraction there, but at the same time I think so it creates a lot of issues when you begin to go down that road. Yeah, Bob.
I think we need to be careful with our human desires and attractions.
Yes.
Proverbs, there is a way that seems right unto man.
Sure.
But then there are ways that.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, that just because something is attractive doesn't mean that it's that it's true or good for us. So, and why should we read? So to come back to Athanasius. So Athanasius was the convert, or the, did you have a point, Ben? Jump in. Go ahead. Yeah, that's right, and I think that's a good point, that when we begin to take divinity away from the second person of the Trinity, that inevitably does harm to how we understand the rest of, you know, what does it mean for God to be the Father, that kind of thing. It potentially does violence to his divinity as well, ultimately. So Athanasius was a man who, through most of his life, did battle with the teachings of Arius, which at times were very popular and actually persuasive in the Christian world. And at this time, we talked last week about it wasn't as though there were the Christians and then there were the heretics. It was more a question of who were the Christians, right? Was Arius faithfully interpreting the scriptures? Was he actually reflective of the Christian faith? Or was when like Athanasius and others, were they more orthodox? And so we can't have this idea that it was, you know, that the heretics are kind of on the outside. It was really a question of who is the heretic and who is the orthodox Christian. So that's the time when Athanasius lived, and he stuck to his guns, so to speak, and really based on, I think as we'll see as we go through this work, because of his understanding of what the scriptures taught, was a careful exegete of the scriptures, and that was ultimately the reason why he adopted the view that he had, and that view was eventually codified first in the Council of Nicaea and then the Council of Constantinople in 381, was when we can really sort of say the period of the influence of Arius ended around that time. All right, so real quick, last week we also talked about this idea of reading old books. Why should we read a book written by a man who lived in the 4th century? It was written about 1,700 years ago or so. What's the value in this? Yeah, Anne. That's true, yeah. Closer to the apostolic age, you mean? Yeah, certainly that there's some wisdom in that. Yep. Doesn't mean they always saw things more clearly, but there is it's a different perspective. Yeah, what else? Right. Yeah, that was the thrust of the argument that C.S. Lewis makes in his introduction to the text that we have, to this edition, is that one of the reasons for reading old books is because we're all inevitably products of the age in which we live in. It's very difficult for us. David Foster Wallace, who's not really necessarily a Christian, but an interesting thinker of the 20th century, he's someone who was giving a commencement speech, he made this analogy talking about two fish hanging out, and another fish comes up, and he says, "Oh, the water is cold today." And the other fish says, "What's water?" Right? You know, like he's just what is water? And because the fish has become so accustomed to the environment in which he swims that there's just an assumption this is just how things are, and could it be any other way? Right? There's no other way it could be, basically. And that is, you know, we might try to mitigate against that. Certainly, as human beings, we have a higher awareness, but at the same time, it's very difficult for us to see clearly what is around us and what is the air we're breathing, what is the water around us. And there's a helpfulness in reading books from a different age that are not necessarily products of the same culture, aren't asking necessarily the same questions, aren't making necessarily the same assumptions, that can help us sort of with some of our blind spots potentially. So I think that's really kind of the thrust of the argument that Lewis makes. And I think also we should say, you know, this is a text that's lasted for 1,700 years. It's still in print, right? You can go buy it on the internet pretty cheaply. People are still investing energy in studying it and writing, you know, dissertations on it, that kind of thing. So it's probably a text worth looking at, right? If it's lasted for almost 2,000 years and still, I think that's part of the argument too. Yeah, Carrie. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, it helps us widen our perspective about our own. Yeah, Christendom did not originate within this country, and it will not end here. So, yeah, it's very helpful for us to realize that. All right, let's move on to some just kind of intro to the text itself. As we, you know, as we understand and try to interpret any text, there's some kind of basic questions that we need to ask hermeneutically, which hermeneutics is just the study of interpretation, essentially. And so some of those basic questions, I think, we need to just explicitly state. So the first one is, when is this text written? And the answer to that is pretty early in Athanasius's career, so to speak, it's probably written before he became Bishop of Alexandria. And the important thing to note there is that it's likely that this is not a text that's written directly against Arius's teaching. It's certainly the case that later in Athanasius's life, much of his work would be taken up with polemic sort of arguments against those who would say that Christ was created, that he was not eternally existent with the Father. But this text itself is not, that's not Athanasius' primary purpose here. And in some sense, that's fortunate. This is a text that is written not just polemically, but it's making more of a broad argument. If you notice in the very first chapter here, Athanasius begins writing, he says, "In our former book, we dealt fully enough with a few of the chief points about the heathen worship of idols and how those false fears originally arose." And so Athanasius there is referring to an earlier text that he wrote that is called Contra Gentiles, or Against Gentiles, Against Heresies, essentially. And that was a book that was more polemical in nature, that was trying to deconstruct those that were believed essentially in forms of idolatry, whether that was Greek philosophy or outright paganism, those kinds of things. And so in that work, Athanasius was more polemical and critical of other ideas, whereas here, in this work, he's going to be making more of a positive argument for what the Scriptures teach, for what we believe about the incarnation and the work of Christ and redemption. Does it make sense? This isn't necessarily a polemical work so much as it is a sort of positive articulation of what the Scriptures teach in Athanasius' judgment. So what language was this text written in? It wasn't written in English, right? We're not reading his original words here. What was it written in? In Greek, yeah. This was the time before Latin became the prominent language of theology. At this time, Greek was still if you were a theologian, you wrote in Greek, basically, at this period of church history. And so Athanasius is someone that is learned in that language, and that's the language that he uses here in this text. And so we talked about, where was Athanasius when he wrote this text? Almost certainly he was in Alexandria. That, as far as we know, that was, except for the times when he was exiled by various contingents of Arius's party. Later in his life, he was a resident of Alexandria, so he likely wrote from that place. And then this final question, and this is often a very important question hermeneutically, is, to whom does Athanasius write this text? He makes a reference, even in the first page, to his audience. Anyone remember that, or have your text with you that you can see that? Who does he identify as the audience? What's that? Macarius, yeah. And Macarius is, it's interesting, we don't fully know exactly who Macarius was. He identifies him here as a true lover of Christ. He says, "Now, Macarius, true lover of Christ, we must take a step further in the faith of our holy religion." And so, again, alluding to that earlier work where he's deconstructed the sort of pagan philosophies, now he's going to make a positive argument. So he refers to Macarius as a lover of Christ. Macarius is a name that means blessed or happy, and so it's not 100% clear whether Macarius was an actual person to whom he wrote, or if it was more of a literary construct where he is writing to someone who is a blessed lover of Christ, who is sort of a generic audience in that sense. So it's not exactly clear. And certainly, even if this was a text written specifically to a person, like the Pauline epistles, right? Paul writes to particular people, particular churches generally, but he also has a broader audience in mind at the same time. And that is certainly the case, I think, here for Athanasius, that even if this is an actual person to whom he's writing, he's doing so with a broader audience in the back of his head. And I think it's, we don't exactly know. We don't know whether Macarius was, he calls him a true lover of Christ here. Does that mean he was already a Christian? Some of the book seems to imply that he's still trying to, you know, make convincing arguments about the Christian faith. And so I think we should say either Macarius is someone who is very interested in Christianity and interested in the scriptures, what they teach, or he's someone who is like a catechumen, someone who has become a convert but is in this period of instruction. Remember, in the early church, if you wanted to become a Christian, you weren't allowed just to be baptized. Right? You had to enter into a period of training and learning, sometimes for up to a year, where you would learn the Christian faith and then finally be baptized, usually on Easter Sunday, with everyone else who had become Christian that year. I think there's some, I'm not convinced that's the way that we should do it. I think the way we do it now is better, in terms of baptizing and then teaching, then discipling and instructing. But that was the practice at that time. And so it's possible that Macarius is a person who's in that category. And I think we should say that this book, on the Incarnation, it sort of walks the line between being an apologetic for the Christian faith, but also an sort of education, introduction. And so it kind of does both of those things. It's both apologetics and education, which is one of its strengths, I think, that it's not simply one or the other. Any other thoughts or questions about those sort of initial ideas of, you know, who's writing this and who's it writing been writing to and that kind of thing? Yes, ma'am. Yeah, Theopolis, yeah. Uh-huh. Well, there's discussion, too, about is Theopolis an actual person that Luke writes to, or is he is that just a sort of generic name for those who love God, right? And so, yeah, that's a very similar kind of thing. Yeah, that's good. This is obviously a literary type that Athanasius is entering into that existed, which is one we've largely fallen away from, right? Most authors of texts these days don't explicitly write to a particular person or even to a particular audience. It's pretty broad in that sense. All right, so here's as we look at this first chapter, hopefully some of y'all were able to read. The first chapter is only about 6 or 7 pages. But if you weren't, that's fine. We're going to kind of work through the argument. But those of you that did look at the text, what's a summary of Athanasius' overall argument in this chapter? How would you summarize his point? Any thoughts? Yeah, Lauren.
I think he summarizes it.
Yes.
I think my verse was actually highlighted, but I don't know what to do. The renewal of creation has been wrought by the self-living word created from the beginning.
Excellent. Yes, I think that's right. So let's look at that. That's on page 10 of the edition that I'm using, the very top of the page, and it's italicized in this edition as well. And now I'm going to begin actually a little further up, actually on the paragraph, the last paragraph on page 9, and begin reading there. I think this is really where he crystallizes and summarizes his argument. He says, "Now in dealing with these matters, it is necessary first to recall what has already been said. You must understand why it is that the word of the Father, so great and so high, has been made manifest in bodily form. He has not assumed a body as proper to his own nature, far from it. For as the word, he is without body." And that's important, right? Before the incarnation, Jesus did not have a physical body. He took on a body in that moment. "He has been manifested in a human body for this reason only, out of the love and goodness of his Father, for the salvation of us men. We will begin, therefore, with the creation of the world and with God as its maker. For the first fact that you must grasp is this: the renewal of creation has been wrought by the selfsame Word who made it in the beginning. There is thus no inconsistency between creation and salvation. For the one Father has employed the same agent for both works, effecting the salvation of the world through the same Word who made it in the beginning. And I think that's a great summary of Athanasius' argument in this chapter. And really, this is going to be his primary argument throughout the book, which is that the incarnation of the Word was something that was consistent with God's original creative act in creating the world, with his original intention towards creation. The incarnation was not something that was, something that deviated from, it fit with the original plan, even though sin came into the world and he had to address that, but it was consistent with God's original attitude towards all of his creation. Does that make sense? Yes, ma'am. Certainly was aware. Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly God had foreknowledge of the fall, foreknowledge of all things. Mm-hmm. And that's, these are difficult questions, right? How does all that fit together? And Athanasius will begin to explain some of that, talk about the freedom of man's will. Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah, certainly the fall was not surprising to God. He had foreknowledge of what would come. Doesn't mean that he caused it, but he... Yeah, there's some of that that comes in this chapter, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so if we're going to say that's the basic argument, and I think we'll see how that works its way out through this chapter... that the redemptive work of the incarnate Son is bound up in God's original creative act and his creation of the world and his good intention for it. That this incarnation is connected to the creation of the world. And of course, we can look at what are some texts in the scriptures where we see this argument being made by the apostles. What's a really prominent one? Beginning of one of the gospels. What's that? Yeah, first chapter of John, right? That's a very, very important. Let's look at that real briefly. I'm sure it's a text we're probably all familiar with, but that's all right. So John, in the beginning of his gospel, he doesn't start with, as the other gospel writers do, right, with a genealogy tracing Christ back to Adam or back to David. He doesn't start just abruptly with it's kind of even skipping the birth, but just going straight to the adult life of Christ, like Mark does. Rather, he goes all the way back, right? He goes all the way back to the beginning of all things, because for John, the incarnation is connected to the creation of the world. So John begins, he says, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it." And so what John's trying to do there is he's trying to say the reason that the light came into the darkness, the reason that the Word became flesh, is because the Word was the one who, through the power of God, created all things. And so the incarnation is consistent with creation. Does that make sense? See how John links those things? We also see Paul doing this in Colossians. Colossians 1 talks about Jesus being the firstborn of all creation. He is the one who made all things. He was preeminent, all this kind of stuff. So connecting those things together become very important in the New Testament. So Athanasius is picking up on this theme and applying it to the situation that he's in. All right? Good. So let's continue through here. So as soon as he makes this argument, he then sort of deviates and begins to talk about some other theories of creation besides the Word being the one who was... creating the world. So he talks about the Epicureans, the Platonists, and the Gnostics. So just real quick, who are the Epicureans? Anybody familiar with that philosophy, approach to life? Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Right. Yep, that was basically the Epicurean idea, was that, they're essentially life is meaningless, and so why not just enjoy it, essentially, enjoy the things that are around us. And it's an argument that Paul seems to interact with in 1 Corinthians 15, for example. And so it was a very hedonist kind of philosophy. And essentially, as Athanasius talks about here, the idea in terms of creation was that there is not any intention behind creation from Epicurean perspective. It just happened. Is that, any of that sound familiar? Right. This is an ancient philosophy, but it's one that is obviously very influential. Maybe not people consciously connecting the dots, but in terms of the assumption of our culture is that if there is no meaning to the universe, there is no maker with intention behind it, then what's the point, right? You may as well live it up to the extent that you have life. You should pursue pleasure, essentially. And of course, we see that working its way out in our culture in all sorts of different ways. Make sense? Okay, so those are Epicureans. So Athanasius knows that that's also a persuasive argument at this time, and there are some who go in that direction, so he argues against it. And his basic argument is that creation can't be meaningless because it shows design. This is almost a precursor of intelligent design kind of argument. Of course, the science didn't exist at this time for Athanasius to prove these things, but he's basically saying, if you look at creation, the meaning is inherent in it, right? Things fit together. Each thing has a part. And so there must have been something behind it. There must have been some intention. And so that's how he approaches this argument of the Epicureans. And then he talks about the Platonists. So what do the Platonists believe about creation? That's right, yeah, that he's impersonal. Yep. And also, in particular, the question of creation, Athanasius talks about the idea that the Creator was one who had, there was pre-existent matter that existed, and he took that and fashioned it. He was more of a craftsman than a creator, right? So dealing with that kind of idea. And so ultimately, the problem is that God is not above the world, right? He's not distinct from it because he's not the genesis of it all, and that becomes an issue. And he talks about the Gnostics as well. What does he talk about the Gnostics? What does he say about the Gnostics here? He says basically Gnostics believe in a creator God that's other than the Father, that is not the Christian God, a God that created the world for other purposes, other intentions. And so he is not... He goes against that argument by linking the work of the Father to creation. He talks about how Jesus does that in Matthew 19, that God has joined together Adam and Eve, and so he is involved in the creative act. There's no other creator other than the Lord, other than the Christian God, the triune God. Any questions about those real brief kind of asides that he makes? Yes, sir. Yeah, I really don't know. That's a good question. Off the top of my head, I'm not familiar with... I'm sure there are some theories about who they were and what they believe, but I'd have to look at that. I don't know if it's connected to anything, any of these ideas. Yes. There you go. There you go. So potentially a Judaizing sect within Christianity, but which the Judaizers were certainly the ones that drew the ire of Paul. So it would not be surprising if Christ felt the same way. So good. Thanks, Allison, Eric. That's great. Okay, so here let's move down. So Athanasius begins to in verse or chapter pages 11 and 12, this idea he wants to as he deconstructs these different ideas about creation and how creation came about. It becomes apparent that it's very important for him that God Himself, the triune God, made all things out of nothing, right? Wasn't pre-existent material, and everything was made by Him. And He did it as a free act. He wasn't under compulsion to do so, but He did it freely with good intention. Why is that important for Athanasius? Or just, why is that important? I mean, this is the Christian doctrine of creation. What's so important about that? God's not dependent on creation, right? He does so freely, He stands above it. Why is it important that God creates all things out of nothing? It's a matter of believing that, you know, stuff existed. Yeah. He's not dependent. Yeah, good. Right. Yeah. All things are dependent on Him. He's not dependent on someone else for creation. Yeah, right. I think it also implies that, you know, that there was just stuff, right? There was no, it was just neutral, right? And God just took it and did stuff with it, right? I think that's an important, as we think ethically and theologically about our lives today. You know, is creation fundamentally good because it comes from the good intention of God? Is being renewed and remade despite human corruption, or is it just neutral stuff, right? Is it just something that happened to exist so God used it? And I think that makes a great deal of difference as we think about our own lives and our own, maybe importantly, even more importantly, our own futures of redemption. Yeah, Anne. Right, it becomes an idea that maybe God just, there wasn't intention from the beginning. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Eric. Oh, sure, right. 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 Yeah, Augustine at times seems to sort of skip over the 6 days of creation, the different acts that God does in those days. Yeah. Yeah, Hal. Right. Yeah. Yeah, purpose finds itself in God.
But we have to distinguish what we say within itself. We have to recognize we're not saying everything's a part of God.
Sure.
God transcends His creation.
Right. Yes, there's a distinction between creator and creation, but the definition of being of creation is that it was created by God, that God is the author and genesis of it. Yes, sir. Yes, Dave. Right. Yes. We are not creators in the same way God is. We sometimes use that shorthand to talk about creation, you know, you created something, but yeah, we're all ultimately craftsmen. We're starting with material that we didn't make, whatever it is that we're doing. Yeah. That's right. All right, let's look at this as we continue through the text. Athanasius makes reference to this book, The Shepherd, which is interesting, I think. He quotes first from Genesis, and then he says, as much in Genesis, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and again through that most helpful book, The Shepherd. Believe thou first and foremost that there is one God who created and arranged all things and brought them out of non-existence into being. And he goes and quotes from Paul as well. It's interesting also that he assumes that Paul is the writer of Hebrews. I'll just put that out there. So what is the shepherd? What text is he referring to here? Anybody know? Yeah, so the footnote. Yeah, so Shepherd of Hermas. So Shepherd of Hermas was an early text written in either the late 1st century or 2nd century and written by a man named Hermas. And there is someone, there's a Hermas mentioned in Romans 16. It could be the same guy. It could be someone different. But Hermas was, the Shepherd of Hermas was an important text early in the church, but it was not one that ultimately was understood to be scripture, was not understood to be canonical. And I just bring it up because I think it's an interesting point to make. You know, Athanasius says here it's helpful. There's helpful content in it. I've read parts of it. So what was the distinction between the Shepherd of Hermas, so this book written by Hermas, and a book like Hebrews or a book like, other epistles that came into the canon? What's the distinction? Good. Yes. That's exactly, that's the point I wanted to draw out, that even from the beginning we see that canonicity is connected to the apostolicity, that the apostles and the apostolic band, that's what makes a book canonical, a book that is inspired by the Spirit. And so Hermas is a helpful book, but it's not the scriptures. It's not the same level. We could talk some about free will here. Maybe we'll come back to that if we have time. I want to make sure that we attend to the other things that Athanasius here. The main point I wanted to make about free will is I think we could read some of the things that Athanasius says here and maybe get a little nervous as Reform folks. So, for example, on page 12, Athanasius says, but since the will of man could turn either way, God secured this grace that he had given by making it conditional, from the first upon two things, namely a law and a place. He set them his own paradise and laid upon them a single prohibition. He talks about, you know, what had happened if they did obey and what if they disobeyed. But sometimes I think we can be a little nervous because it seems as though, you know, God, what does this mean? You know, Adam and Eve could just do whatever they wanted and God wasn't sovereign. I think it's important for us to say, like, I can quote you from the confession, I can do that if we have time later, but essentially this is what Athanasius is saying here is what the confession teaches, that man was free to choose. That does not mean that God wasn't sovereign over it, right? It doesn't mean that he didn't providentially arrange all things, but he also gave man true freedom of will in the garden, and that's a very important thing. The confession is very careful to guard, that we're not saying that God, you know, that man only had one choice, which was to fall, to eat the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. But there was genuine freedom there. Does that make sense? I just want to connect that to what we believe today, that this isn't something that where he's going off the page, so to speak. Let's skip down. I want to make sure that we give some time for discussion. So, As we talk about this idea that sort of works its way through, Athanasius talks about the creation and its connection to the goodness of God, his goodness. He then talks about the fall of mankind and the corruption that is introduced into creation through the sin of man. And then he sort of ends the argument in kind of a dire situation, right? He talks about all sin sort of multiplies, and it quotes from Romans 1 about how the corruption runs manifest throughout all creation. And that's going to set him up for the next several chapters, which basically is, what's God going to do, right, in reference to this problem that is before mankind, that God intended good creation, and he made it good, and yet corruption has been introduced. And so how does that create a dilemma for God, and how does he respond to it? And, of course, the answer is the incarnation, is the solution. But what, as we think about just sort of how do we apply this passage to our lives, what are any favorite passages that I haven't quoted that you all noticed? Yeah, Lauren. It's okay. Absolutely. Yeah, I would think so. Yeah, absolutely. I think that's an important point theologically, that evil is essentially the absence of God. There doesn't have an existence in and of itself. And I think that's important because sometimes we can have this idea that, and Lewis talks about this in his own writings, I'm sure he was influenced by Athanasius and Augustine, that, you know, that God and Satan are sort of equal rivals, right? And they're quarreling over the world. And that's really mistaken. Satan doesn't have any inherent power in himself, right? He is a created being. And evil is simply, as Athanasius puts it here, it's non-being. It's the absence of God. It's not a, you know, there's not some kind of eternal struggle between light and darkness that's equal. That's an important point to make. What else? Any other passages that you all stood out to you? This would have been written before the great councils of Nicaea and Constantinople. Here's one I really love. This is on the bottom of page 12, where it starts the paragraph or mini chapter starts with the numeral 4. He says, "You may be wondering why we're discussing the origin of man when we set out to talk about the words becoming man," right? The point of this is, Macarius thought, was about the incarnation, but Athanasius is going back and talking about creation of man. He says, "The former subject is relevant to the latter for this reason. It was our sorry case that caused the Word to come down, our transgression that called out His love for us, so that He made haste to help us and to appear among us. It is we who are the cause of His taking human form, and for our salvation that in His great love He was both born and manifested in a human body." I think those are just beautiful lines. I mean, that's just really cogent, classic sort of argument for what we believe in terms of the Christian faith. It was for His love for us that made Him make haste and come down to us and become like us. I just think this is a really articulate way of putting it. And I think that's a lot of the value of this book, is that it is a very clear summary of the Christian faith, and cogent and articulate, and I think persuasive. It's good for us to meditate on those things. All right, here I just want to end with a couple of questions for application. So if we accept Athanasius' argument about the incarnation and creation being linked, then what difference does that make? How should we view creation today? Is the physical creation around us, is it our enemy? Is it something we must be freed from in order to commune with God? What's that? God said it was good. Yeah, Mark said no. You want to unpack that, Mark? It's to be enjoyed. Yeah. Mm-hmm. 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 Yeah. Yeah, there's sometimes this idea that to be spiritual means to be detached from creation or to get away from physical matter, right? To escape from our bodies. That's certainly a belief that was prevalent in the 4th century, and I think it's still prevalent today. You know, Gnosticism is the word that's often associated with that idea. And it's not something that's alien and even from American evangelicalism. I think it's, you know, there are subtle ways in which Gnostic forms of spirituality are accepted and advanced. And I think what Athanasius is doing here is laying a groundwork for an argument against that, that no, creation was good, was God's original purpose, and the incarnation, that even the act of redemption is created, or is connected to that creative work, to physical matter. And so we shouldn't see it as our enemy or something we have to be freed from, but something that God is renewing and remaking. And I just have this final thing here. If we accept Athanasius' argument regarding the connection of the incarnation to God's original act of creation, then what should we expect regarding the outcome of his redemptive work in his Son? What would be the outcome be ultimately, we would expect? If God made creation good, if the incarnation is connected to his desire to undo the corruption that man introduced through sin, what should we expect about the ultimate end of redemption? Hallelujah. Yeah. And he's making all things new, right? The renewal of creation, right? Salvation, if we accept this, doesn't mean that we escape from creation, but it means that creation is remade and renewed and restored. And that's what we see, I think, in the New Testament. You know, the resurrection of the body, the renewal of all things, the new earth that we see described at the end of Revelation. And so I think it's important. The order of these things matter, and it doesn't make any sense to believe in all that unless you see the connection between the goodness of creation and the incarnation itself, that those things are all linked together. Yes, ma'am. One final question. Like environmental kind of concerns?
Pardon?
Like environmental concerns?
Yeah, and the animal rescues and all these kind of things where man is actually trying to destroy the world. And yet we see people doing it. Is that what? Are they working with God?
Yeah, it's good. I mean, I think that's a huge topic, one we probably can't cover right now. But I think certainly we as Christians should care about the creation, the world that the Lord has given us, and seek to manage it and protect it and care for it. But we also have to remember that human beings are the pinnacle of creation. They are what is called very good. Human beings are the ones that bear the image of God. And so we have to make sure we're prioritizing things in the right way. But yeah, certainly at times Christians have ignored caring for creation in a way that doesn't fit with, I think, the trajectory of the scriptures.